Kroger, an annual Boost membership just got even better. Now you can choose from Disney Plus with ads, Hulu with ads, or ESPN Plus on us when you sign up. Plus, enjoy unlimited free delivery, double fuel points, exclusive offers, and free items. Sign up for a Boost membership today. It's an easier way to save, including new streaming options to relax with while we deliver your groceries. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest, over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
Book 2, Chapters 3-6 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 3. Brick. 1. Beginning with bricks, I shall state of what kind of clay they ought to be made. They should not be made of sandy or pebbly clay, or of fine gravel, because when made of these kinds they are in the first place heavy, and secondly, when washed by the rain as they stand in walls, they go to pieces and break up, and the straw in them does not hold together on account of the roughness of the material. They should rather be made of white and chalky, or of red clay, or even a coarse-grained gravelly clay. These materials are smooth and therefore durable. They are not heavy to work with, and are readily laid. 2. Bricks should be made in spring or autumn, so that they may drive uniformly. Those made in summer are defective, because the fierce heat of the sun bakes their surface and makes the brick seem dry, while inside it is not dry. And so the shrinking, which follows as they dry, causes cracks in the parts which were dried before, and these cracks make the bricks weak. Bricks will be most serviceable if made 2 years before using, for they cannot dry thoroughly in less time. When fresh undried bricks are used in a wall, the stucco covering stiffens and hardens into a permanent mass, but the bricks settle and cannot keep the same height as the stucco. The motion caused by their shrinking prevents them from adhering to it, and they are separated from their union with it. Hence the stucco, no longer joined to the core of the wall, cannot stand by itself because it is so thin. It breaks off, and the walls themselves may perhaps be ruined by their settling. This is so true that at Attica, in constructing walls, they use brick only if it is dry and made 5 years previously, and approved as such by the authority of a magistrate. 3. There are three kinds of bricks. First, the kind called in Greek Lydian, being that which our people use, 1.5 feet long and 1 foot wide. The other two kinds are used by the Greeks in their buildings. Of these, one is called pentadoron, the other tetradoron. Doron is the Greek for palm, for in Greek doron means the giving of gifts, and the gift is always presented in the palm of the hand. A brick 5 palms square is called pentadoron, 1 4-palm square tetradoron. Public buildings are constructed of pentadora, private of tetradora. 4. With these bricks there are also half bricks. When these are used in a wall, a course of bricks is laid on one face and a course of half bricks on the other, and they are bedded to the line on each face. The walls are bonded by alternate courses of the two different kinds, and as the bricks are always laid so as to break joints, this lends strength and a not unattractive appearance to both sides of such walls. In the states of Maxilua and Calais in further Spain, as well as in Pitane in Asia Minor, there are bricks which, when finished and dried, will float on being thrown in water. The reason why they can float seems to be that the clay of which they are made is like pumice stone. So it is light, and also it does not, after being hardened by exposure to the air, take up or absorb liquid. So these bricks, being of this light and porous quality, and admitting no moisture into their texture, must by laws of nature float in water like pumice, no matter what their weight may be. They have therefore great advantages, for they are not heavy to use in building, and, once made, they are not spoiled by bad weather. Chapter 4. Sand. 1. In walls of masonry, the first question must be with regard to the sand, in order that it may be fit to mix into mortar and have no dirt in it. The kinds of pitsand are these: black, grey, red, and carbuncular. Of these, the best will be found to be that which crackles when rubbed in the hand, while that which has much dirt in it will not be sharp enough. Again, throw some sand upon a white garment and then shake it out. If the garment is not soiled and no dirt adheres to it, the sand is suitable. 2. But if there are no sandpits from which it can be dug, then we must sift it out from riverbeds or from gravel or even from the sea beach. This kind, however, has these defects when used in masonry. It dries slowly. The wall cannot be built without interruption, but from time to time there must be pauses in the work, and such a wall cannot carry vaultings. Furthermore, when sea sand is used in walls, and these are coated with stucco, a salty effluence is given out which spoils the surface. 3. But pitsand used in masonry dries quickly. The stucco coating is permanent, and the walls can support vaultings. I am speaking of sand fresh from the sandpits, for if it lies unused too long after being taken out, it is disintegrated by exposure to sun, moon, or hoar frost, and becomes earthy. So when mixed in masonry, it has no binding power on the rubble, which consequently settles, and down comes the load which the walls can no longer support. Fresh pitsand, however, in spite of all its excellence in concrete structures, is not equally useful in stucco, the richness of which, when the lime and straw are mixed with such sand, will cause it to crack as it dries on account of the great strength of the mixture. But river sand, though useless in signum on account of its thinness, becomes perfectly solid in stucco when thoroughly worked by means of polishing instruments. Chapter 5. Lime. 1. Sand and its sources have been thus treated. Next, with regard to lime, we must be careful that it is burned from a stone which, whether soft or hard, is in any case white. Lime made of close-grained stone of the harder sort will be good in structural parts, lime of poorer stone in stucco. After slaking it, mix your mortar, if using pitsand, in the proportions of 3 parts of sand to 1 of lime. If using river or sea sand, mix 2 parts of sand with 1 of lime. These will be the right proportions for the composition of the mixture. Further, in using river or sea sand, the addition of 1/3 part composed of burnt brick, pounded up and sifted, will make your mortar of a better composition to use. 2. The reason why lime makes a solid structure on being combined with water and sand seems to be this: that rocks, like all other bodies, are composed of the 4 elements. Those which contain a larger proportion of air are soft, of water are tough from the moisture, of earth hard, and of fire more brittle. Therefore, if limestone, without being burned, is merely pounded up small and then mixed with sand and so put into the work, the mass does not solidify nor can it hold together. But if the stone is first thrown into the kiln, it loses its former property of solidity by exposure to the great heat of the fire, and so with its strength burnt out and exhausted, it is left with its pores open and empty. Hence, the moisture and air in the body of the stone being burned out and set free, and only a residuum of heat being left lying in it, if the stone is then immersed in water, the moisture, before the water can feel the influence of the fire, makes its way into the open pores. Then the stone begins to get hot, and finally, after it cools off, the heat is rejected from the body of the lime. 3. Consequently, limestone, when taken out of the kiln, cannot be as heavy as when it is thrown in, but on being weighed, through its bulk remains the same as before. It is found to have lost about a third of its weight, owing to the boiling out of the water. Therefore, its pores being thus opened and its texture rendered loose, it readily mixes with sand, and hence the two materials cohere as they dry, unite with the rubble, and make a solid structure. Chapter 6. Pozzolana. 1. There is also a kind of powder which from natural causes produces astonishing results. It is found in the neighborhood of Baiae and in the country belonging to the towns round about Mount Vesuvius. This substance, when mixed with lime and rubble, not only lends strength to the buildings of other kinds, but even when piers of it are constructed in the sea, they set hard under water. The reason for this seems to be that the soil on the slopes of the mountains in these neighborhoods is hot and full of hot springs. This would not be so unless the mountains had beneath them huge fires of burning sulfur or alum or asphalt. So the fire and heat of the flames coming up hot from far within through the fissures make the soil there light, and the tufa found there is spongy and free from moisture. Hence, when the three substances, all formed on a similar principle by the force of fire, are mixed together, the water suddenly taken in makes them cohere, and the moisture quickly hardens them so that they set into a mass which neither the waves nor the force of the water can dissolve. 2. That there is a burning heat in these regions may be proved by the further fact that in the mountains near Baiae, which belongs to the Cumians, there are places excavated to serve as sweating baths, where the intense heat that comes from far below bores its way through the earth owing to the force of the fire, and passing up appears in these regions, thus making remarkably good sweating baths. Likewise also it is related that in ancient times the tides of heat swelling and overflowing from under Mount Vesuvius vomited forth fire from the mountain upon the neighboring country. Hence, what is called sponge stone or Pompeian pumice appears to have been reduced by burning from another kind of stone to the condition of the kind which we see. 3. The kind of sponge stone taken from this region is not produced everywhere else, but only about Aetna and among the hills of Mysia, which the Greeks called the burnt district, and in other places of the same peculiar nature. Seeing that in such places there are found hot springs and warm vapor in excavations on the mountains, and that the ancients tell us that there were once fires spreading over the fields in those very regions, it seems to be certain that moisture has been extracted from the tufa and earth by the force of fire, just as it is from limestone in kilns. Therefore, when different and unlike things have been subjected to the action of fire and thus reduced to the same condition, if after this, while in a warm, dry state, they are suddenly saturated with water, there is an effervescence of the heat latent in the bodies of them all, and this makes them firmly unite and quickly assume the property of one solid mass. There will still be the question why Tuscany, although it abounds in hot springs, does not furnish a powder out of which, on the same principle, a wall can be made which will set fast under water. I have therefore thought best to explain how this seems to be, before the question should be raised. 5. The same kinds of soil are not found in all places and countries alike, nor is stone found everywhere. Some soils are earthy, others gravelly, and again pebbly. In other places the material is sandy. In a word, the properties of the soil are as different and unlike as are the various countries. In particular, it may be observed that sand pits are hardly ever lacking in any place within the districts of Italy and Tuscany, which are bounded by the Apennines, whereas across the Apennines toward the Adriatic none are found, and in Achaia and Asia Minor, or in short, across the sea, the very term is unknown. Hence it is not in all the places where boiling springs of hot water abound that there is the same combination of favorable circumstances which has been described above. For things are produced in accordance with the will of nature, not to suit man's pleasure, but, as it were, by a chance distribution. 6. Therefore, whether mountains are not earthy, but consist of soft stone, the force of the fire, passing through the fissures in the stone, sets it afire. The soft and delicate part is burned out, while the hard part is left. Consequently, while in Campania the burning of the earth makes ashes, in Tuscany the combustion of the stone makes carbuncular sand. Both are excellent in walls, but one is better to use for buildings on land, the other for piers under salt water. The Tuscan stone is softer in quality than tufa, but harder than earth, and being thoroughly kindled by the violent heat from below, the result is the production in some places of the kind of sand called carbuncular. End of Book 2, Chapter 6. Book 2, Chapters 7 to 8 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 7. Stone. 1. I have now spoken of lime and sand with their varieties and points of excellence. Next comes the consideration of stone quarries, from which dimension stone and supplies of rubble to be used in building are taken and brought together. The stone in quarries is found to be of different and unlike qualities. In some it is soft, for example in the environs of the city at the quarries of Grotta Rossa, Palla, Fidenae, and of the Alban Hills. In others it is medium, as at Tivoli, at Amiternum, and Mount Soracte, and in quarries of this sort. In still others it is hard, as in lava quarries. There are also numerous other kinds, for instance in Campania, red and black tufas, in Umbria, Picenum, and Venezia, white tufa, which can be cut with a toothed saw, like wood. 2. All these soft kinds have the advantage that they can be easily worked as soon as they have been taken from the quarries. Under cover they play their part well, but in open and exposed situations the frost and rime make them crumble, and they go to pieces. On the sea coast, too, the salt eats away and dissolves them, nor can they stand great heat either. But travertine and all stone of that class can stand injury, whether from a heavy load laid upon it or from the weather. Exposure to fire, however, it cannot bear, but splits and cracks to pieces at once. This is because in its natural composition there is but little moisture and not much of the earthy, but a great deal of air and of fire. Therefore it is not only without the earthy and watery elements, but when fire, expelling the air from it by the operation of force of heat, penetrates into its inmost parts and occupies the empty spaces of the fissures, there comes a great glow, and the stone is made to burn as fiercely as do the particles of fire itself. 3. There are also several quarries, called Anician, in the territory of Tarquinii, the stone being of the color of peperino. The principal workshops lie around the lake of Bolsena and in the prefecture of Statonia. This stone has innumerable good qualities. Neither the season of frost nor exposure to fire can harm it, but it remains solid and lasts to a great age, because there is only a little air and fire in its natural composition, a moderate amount of moisture, and a great deal of the earthy. Hence its structure is of close texture and solid, and so it cannot be injured by the weather or by force of fire. 4. This may best be seen from monuments in the neighborhood of the town of Ferento, which are made of stone from these quarries. Among them are large statues exceedingly well made, images of smaller size, and flowers and acanthus leaves gracefully carved. Old as these are, they look as fresh as if they were only just finished. Bronze workers, also, make molds for the casting of bronze out of stone from these quarries, and find it very useful in bronze founding. If the quarries were only near Rome, all our buildings might well be constructed from the products of these workshops. 5. But since, on account of the proximity of the stone quarries of Grotta Rossa, Palla, and the others that are nearest to the city, necessity drives us to make use of their products, we must proceed as follows if we wish our work to be finished without flaws. Let the stone be taken from the quarry 2 years before building is to begin, and not in winter but in summer. But let it lie exposed in an open place. Such stone as has been damaged by the 2 years of exposure should be used in the foundations. The rest, which remains unhurt, has passed the test of nature and will endure in those parts of the building which are above ground. This precaution should be observed not only with dimension stone, but also with the rubble, which is used in walls. Chapter 8. Methods of Building Walls. 1. There are two styles of walls, opus reticulatum, now used by everybody, and the ancient style called opus incertum. Of these, the reticulatum looks better, but its construction makes it likely to crack, because its beds and builds spread out in every direction. On the other hand, in the opus incertum, the rubble, lying in courses and imbricated, makes a wall, though not beautiful, is stronger than reticulatum. 2. Both kinds should be constructed of the smaller stones, so that the walls, being thoroughly puddled with the mortar, which is made of lime and sand, may hold together longer. Since the stones used are soft and porous, they are apt to suck the moisture out of the mortar and so to dry it up. But when there is abundance of lime and sand, the wall, containing more moisture, will not soon lose its strength, for they will hold it together. But as soon as the moisture is sucked out of the mortar by the porous rubble, and the lime and sand separate and disunite, the rubble can no longer adhere to them, and the wall will in time become a ruin. 3. This we may learn from several monuments in the environs of the city, which are built of marble or dimension stone, but on the inside packed with masonry between the outer walls. In the course of time, the mortar has lost its strength, which has been sucked out of it by the porousness of the rubble, and so the monuments are tumbling down and going to pieces, with their joints loosened by the settling of the material that bound them together. 4. He who wishes to avoid such a disaster should leave a cavity behind the facing, and on the inside build walls 2 feet thick, made of red dimension stone, or burnt brick, or lava in courses, and then bind them to the fronts by means of iron clamps and lead. For thus his work, being no more heap of material, but regularly laid in courses, will be strong enough to last forever without a flaw, because the beds and builds, all settling equally and bonded at the joints, will not let the work bulge out, nor allow the fall of the face walls which have been tightly fastened together. 5. Consequently, the method of construction employed by the Greeks is not to be despised. They do not use a structure of soft rubble polished on the outside, but whenever they forsake dimension stone, they lay courses of lava or of some hard stone, as though building with brick. They bind the upright joints by interchanging the direction of the stones as they lie in the courses. Thus they attain to a perfection that will endure to eternity. These structures are of two kinds. One of them is called isodomum, the other pseudisodomum. 6. A wall is called isodomum when all the courses are of equal height, pseudisodomum when the rows of courses do not match but run unequally. Both kinds are strong, first because the rubble itself is of close texture and solid, unable to suck the moisture out of the mortar, but keeping it in its moist condition for a very long period. Secondly, because the beds of the stones, being laid smooth and level to begin with, keep the mortar from falling, and as they are bonded throughout the entire thickness of the wall, they hold together for a very long period. 7. Another method is which they call emplecton, used also among us in the country. In this the facings are finished, but the other stones left in their natural state and then laid with alternate bonding stones. But our workmen, in their hurry to finish, devote themselves only to the facings of the walls, setting them upright but filling the space between with a lot of broken stones and mortar thrown in anyhow. This makes 3 different sections in the same structure, 2 consisting of facing and 1 of filling between them. The Greeks, however, do not build so, but lying their stones level and building every other stone lengthwise into the thickness, they do not fill the space between, but construct the thickness of their walls in one solid and unbroken mass from the facings to the interior. Further, at intervals, they lay single stone which run through the entire thickness of the wall. These stones, which show at each end, are called diatonoi, and by their bonding powers they add very greatly to the solidity of the walls. 8. One who, in accordance with these notes, will take pains in selecting his method of construction, may count upon having something that will last. No walls made of rubble and finished with delicate beauty, no such walls can escape ruin as time goes on. Hence, when arbitrators are chosen to set a valuation on party walls, they do not value them at what they cost to build, but look up the written contract in each case, and then, after deducting from the cost 1/80th for each year that the wall has been standing, decide that the remainder is the sum to be paid. They thus in effect pronounce that such walls can last more than 80 years. 9. In the case of brick walls, however, no deduction is made provided that they are still standing plumb, but they are always valued at what they cost to build. Hence, in some states we may see public buildings and private houses, as well as those of kings, built of brick. In Athens, for example, the part of the wall which faces Mount Hymettus and Pentelicus, at Patras, the cellae of the temple of Jupiter and Hercules, which are brick, although on the outside the entablature and columns of the temple are of stone. In Italy, at Arezzo, an ancient wall excellently built. At Tralles, the house built for the kings of the dynasty of Attalus, which is now always granted to the man who holds the state priesthood. In Sparta, paintings have been taken out of certain walls by cutting through the bricks, then have been placed in wooden frames, and so brought to the Comitium to adorn the aedileship of Varro and Marina. 10. Then there is the house of Croesus, which the people of Sardis have set apart as a place of repose for their fellow citizens in the retirement of age. A gerousia for the build of the elder men. At Halicarnassus, the house of that most potent king, Mausolus, though decorated throughout with Proconnesian marble, has walls built of brick which are to this day of extraordinary strength, and are covered with stucco so highly polished that they seem to be as glistening as glass. That king did not use brick from poverty, but he was chokeful of revenues, being ruler of all Caria. 11. As for his skill and ingenuity as a builder, they may be seen from what follows. He was born at Melassa, but recognizing the natural advantages of Halicarnassus as a fortress, and seeing that it was suitable as a trading center, and that it had a good harbor, he fixed his residence there. The place had a curvature like that of a seat in a theater. On the lowest tier, along the harbor, was built the forum. About halfway up the curving slope, at the point where the curved cross aisle is in a theater, a broad, wide street was laid out, in the middle of which was built the mausoleum, a work so remarkable that it was classed among the 7 wonders of the world. At the top of the hill, in the center, is the fane of Mars, containing a colossal acrolithic statue by the famous hand of Leocharis. That is, some think that this statue is by Leocharis, others by Timotheus. At the extreme right of the summit is the fane of Venus and Mercury, close to the spring of Salmasis. 12. There is a mistaken idea that this spring infects those who drink of it with unnatural lewdness. It will not be out of place to explain how this idea came to spread throughout the world from a mistake in the telling of the tale. It cannot be that the water makes men effeminate and unchaste, as it is said to do. For the spring is of remarkable clearness and excellent in flavor. The fact is that when Melas and Arevanias came there from Argos and Troezen and founded a colony together, they drove out the Carians and Lelegans, who were barbarians. These took refuge in the mountains, and uniting there used to make raids, plundering the Greeks and laying their country waste in a cruel manner. Later, one of the colonists, to make money, set up a well-stocked shop near the spring because the water was so good, and the way in which he carried it on attracted the barbarians. So they began to come down, one at a time, and to meet with society, and thus they were brought back of their own accord, giving up the rough and savage way for the delights of Greek customs. Hence this water acquired its peculiar reputation, not because it really induced unchastity, but because those barbarians were softened by the charm of civilization. 13. But since I have been tempted into giving a description of this fortified place, it remains to finish my account of it. Corresponding to the fane of Venus and the spring described above, which are on the right, we have on the extreme left the royal palace which King Mausolus built there in accordance with a plan all his own. To the right it commands a view of the forum, the harbour, and the entire line of fortifications, while just below it, to the left, there is a concealed harbour, hidden under the walls in such a way that nobody could see or know what was going on in it. Only the king himself could, in case of need, give orders from his own palace to the oarsmen and soldiers without the knowledge of anybody else. 14. After the death of Mausolus, his wife Artemisia became queen, and the Rhodians, regarding it as an outrage that a woman should be ruler of the states of all Caria, fitted out a fleet and sailed forth to seize upon the kingdom. When news of this reached Artemisia, she gave orders that her fleet should be hidden away in that harbour with oarsmen and marines mustered and concealed, but that the rest of the citizens should take their places on the city wall. After the Rhodians had landed at the larger harbour with their well-equipped fleet, she ordered the people on the wall to cheer them and to promise that they would deliver up the town. Then, when they had passed inside the wall, leaving their fleet empty, Artemisia suddenly made a canal which led to the sea, brought her fleet thus out of the smaller harbour, and so sailed into the larger. Disembarking her soldiers, she towed the empty fleet of the Rhodians out to sea. So the Rhodians were surrounded without means of retreat, and were slain in the very forum. 15. So Artemisia embarked her own soldiers and oarsmen in the ships of the Rhodians and set forth for Rhodes. The Rhodians, beholding their own ships approaching, wreathed with laurel, supposed that their fellow citizens were returning victorious and admitted the enemy. Then Artemisia, after taking Rhodes and killing its leading men, put up in the city of Rhodes a trophy of her victory, including two bronze statues, one representing the state of the Rhodians, the other herself. Herself she fashioned in the act of branding the state of the Rhodians. In later times, the Rhodians, laboring under the religious scruple which makes it a sin to remove trophies once they are dedicated, constructed a building to surround the place, and thus be the erection of the Grecian station, covered it so that nobody could see it, and ordered that the building be called Abaton. 16. Since such very powerful kings have not disdained walls built of brick, although with their revenues and from booty they might often have had them not only of masonry or dimension stone, but even of marble, I think that one ought not to reject buildings made of brickwork, provided that they are properly topped. But I shall explain why this kind of structure should not be used by the Roman people within the city, not omitting the reasons and the grounds for them. 17. The laws of the state forbid that walls abutting on public property should be more than a foot and a half thick. The other walls are built of the same thickness in order to save space. Now brick walls, unless two or three bricks thick, cannot support more than one story, certainly not if they are only a foot and a half in thickness. But with the present importance of the city and the unlimited numbers of its population, it is necessary to increase the number of dwelling places indefinitely. Consequently, as the ground floor should not admit of so great a number living in the city, the nature of the case has made it necessary to find relief by making the buildings high. In these tall piles, reared with piers of stone, walls of burnt brick, and partitions of rubble work, and provided with floor after floor, the upper stories can be partitioned off into rooms to very great advantage. The accommodations within the city walls being thus multiplied as a result of the many floors high in the air, the Roman people easily find excellent places in which to live. 18. It has now been explained how limitations of building space necessarily forbid the employment of brick walls within the city. When it becomes necessary to use them outside the city, they should be constructed as follows in order to be perfect and durable. On the top of the wall lay a structure of burnt brick about a foot and a half in height, under the tiles and projecting like a coping. Thus the defects usual in these walls can be avoided. For when the tiles on the roof are broken or thrown down by the wind so that rainwater can leak through, this burnt brick coating will prevent the crude brick from being damaged, and the cornice-like projection will throw off the drops beyond the vertical face, and thus the walls, though of crude brick structure, will be preserved intact. 19. With regard to burnt brick, nobody can tell offhand whether it is of the best or unfit to use in a wall, because its strength can be tested only after it has been used on a roof and exposed to bad weather and time. Then, if it is good, it is accepted. If not made of good clay, or if not baked sufficiently, it shows itself defective there when exposed to frost and rime. Brick that will not stand exposure on roofs can never be strong enough to carry its load in a wall. Hence the strongest burnt brick walls are those which are constructed out of old roofing tiles. 20. As for Watlin daub, I could wish that it had never been invented. The more it saves in time and gains in space, the greater and the more general is the disaster that it may cause, for it is made to catch fire like torches. It seems better, therefore, to spend on walls of burnt brick and be at expense than to save with Watlin daub and be in danger. And in the stucco covering, too, it makes cracks from the inside by the arrangement of its studs and girts. For these swell with moisture as they are daubed and then contract as they are dry, and by their shrinking cause the solid stucco to split. But since some are obliged to use it either to save time or money, or for partitions on an unsupported span, the proper method of construction is as follows. Give it a high foundation, so that it may nowhere come in contact with a broken stonework composing the floor, for if it is sunk in this, it rots in course of time, then settles and sags forward, and so breaks through the surface of the stucco covering. I have now explained to the best of my ability the subject of walls and the preparation of the different kinds of material employed, with their advantages and disadvantages. Next, following the guidance of nature, I shall treat of the framework and the kinds of good used in it, showing how they may be procured of a sort that will not give way as time goes on. End of Book 2, Chapter 8. Book 2, Chapters 9 to 10 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius, translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 9. Timber. 1. Timber should be felled between early autumn and the time when Favonius begins to blow. For in spring all trees become pregnant, and they are all employing their natural vigor in the production of leaves and the fruits that return every year. The requirements of that season render them empty and swollen, and so they are weak and feeble because of their looseness of texture. This is also the case with women who have conceived. Their bodies are not considered perfectly healthy until the child is born. Hence, pregnant slaves, when offered for sale, are not warranted sound, because the fetus, as it grows within the body, takes to itself as nourishment all the best qualities of the mother's food, and so the stronger it becomes as the full time for birth approaches, the less compact it allows the body to be from which it is produced. After the birth of the child, what was heretofore taken to promote the growth of another creature is now set free by the delivery of the newborn, and the channels being now empty and open, the body take it in by lapping up its juices, and thus becomes compact and returns to the natural strength which it had before. 2. On the same principle, with the ripening of the fruits in autumn, the leaves begin to wither, and the trees, taking up their sap from the earth through the roots, recover themselves and are restored to their former solid texture. But the strong air of winter compresses and solidifies them during the time above mentioned. Consequently, if the timber is felled on the principle and at the time above mentioned, it will be felled at the proper season. 3. In felling a tree, we should cut into the trunk of it to the very heart, and then leave it standing so that the sap may drain out drop by drop throughout the whole of it. In this way, the useless liquid which is within will run out through the sapwood instead of having to die in a mass of decay, thus spoiling the quality of the timber. Then, and not till then, the tree being drained dry and the sap no longer dripping, let it be felled, and it will be in the highest state of usefulness. 4. That this is so may be seen in the case of fruit trees. When these are tapped at the base and pruned, each at the proper time, they pour out from the heart through the tap holes all the superfluous and corrupting fluid which they contain, and thus the draining process makes them durable. But when the juices of trees have no means of escape, they clot and rot in them, making the trees hollow and good for nothing. Therefore, if the draining process does not exhaust them while they are still alive, there is no doubt that, if the same principle is followed in felling them for timber, they will last a long time and be very useful in buildings. 5. Trees vary and are unlike one another in their qualities. Thus it is with the oak, elm, poplar, cypress, fir, and the others which are most suitable to use in buildings. The oak, for instance, has not the efficacy of the fir, nor the cypress that of the elm. Nor in the case of other trees is it natural that they should be alike, but the individual kinds are effective in building, some in one way, some in another, owing to the different properties of their elements. 6. To begin with fir, it contains a great deal of air and fire with very little moisture and the earthy, so that as its natural properties are of the lighter class, it is not heavy. Hence, its consistence being naturally stiff, it does not easily bend under the load, and keeps its straightness when used in the framework. But it contains so much heat that it generates and encourages decay which spoils it, and it also kindles fire quickly because of the air in its body, which is so open that it takes in fire and so gives out a great flame. 7. The part which is nearest to the earth before the tree is cut down takes up moisture through the roots from the immediate neighborhood and hence is without knots and is clear. But the upper part, on account of the great heat in it, throws up branches into the air through the knots, and this, when it is cut off about 20 feet from the ground and then hewn, is called knotwood, because of its hardness and knottiness. The lowest part after the tree is cut down and the sapwood of the same thrown away is split into 4 pieces and prepared for joiner's work and so is called clear stock. 8. Oak, on the other hand, having enough and to spare of the earthy among its elements and containing but little moisture, air, and fire, lasts for an unlimited period when buried in underground structures. It follows that when exposed to moisture, as its texture is not loose and porous, it cannot take in liquid on account of its compactness, but withdrawing from the moisture it resists it and warps, thus making cracks in the structures in which it is used. 9. The winter oak, being composed of a moderate amount of all the elements, is very useful in buildings, but when in moist place it takes in water to its center through its pores, its air and fire being expelled by the influence of the moisture, and so it rots. The turkey oak and the beech, both containing a mixture of moisture, fire, and the earthy, with a great deal of air, through this loose texture take in moisture to the center and soon decay. White and black poplar, as well as willow, linden, and the agnus castus, containing an abundance of fire and air, a moderate amount of moisture, and only a small amount of the earthy, are composed of a mixture which is proportionately rather light, and so they are of great service from the stiffness. Although on account of the mixture of the earthy in them they are not hard, yet their loose texture makes them gleaming white, and they are a convenient material to use in carving. The alder, which is produced close by river banks, and which seems to be altogether useless as building material, has really excellent qualities. It is composed of a very large proportion of air and fire, not much of the earthy, and only a little moisture. Hence, in swampy places, alder piles driven close together beneath the foundations of buildings take in the water which their own consistence lacks and remain imperishable forever, supporting structures of enormous weight and keeping them from decay. Thus a material which cannot last even a little while above ground endures for a long time when covered with moisture. 11. One can see this at its best in Ravenna, for there all the buildings, both public and private, have piles of this sort beneath their foundations. The elm and the ash contain a very great amount of moisture, a minimum of fire and air, and a moderate mixture of the earthy in their composition. When put in shape for use in buildings, they are tough, and having no stiffness on account of the weight of moisture in them, soon bend. But when they become dry with age, and are allowed to lose their sap and die standing in the open, they get harder, and from their toughness supply a strong material for dowels to be used in joints and other articulations. 12. The hornbeam, which has a very small amount of fire and of the earthy in its composition, but a very great proportion of air and moisture, is not a wood that breaks easily, and is very convenient to handle. Hence the Greeks call it zygia, because they make of it yokes for their draught animals, and their word for yoke is zyga. Cypress and pine are also just as admirable, for although they contain an abundance of moisture mixed with an equivalent composed of all the other elements, and so are apt to warp when used in buildings on account of this superfluity of moisture, yet they can be kept to a great age without rotting, because the liquid contained within their substances has a bitter taste which by its pungency prevents the entrance of decay or of those little creatures which are destructive. Hence, buildings made of these kinds of wood last for an unending period of time. 13. The cedar and the juniper tree have the same uses and good qualities, but while the cypress and pine yield resin, from the cedar is produced an oil called cedar oil. Books as well as other things smeared with this are not hurt by worms or decay. The foliage of this tree is like that of the cypress, but the grain of the wood is straight. The statue of Diana in the temple of Ephesus is made of it, and so are the coffered ceilings, both there and in all other famous fanes, because that wood is everlasting. The tree grows chiefly in Crete, Africa, and in some districts of Syria. 14. The larch, known only to the people of the towns on the banks of the river Po and the shores of the Adriatic, is not only preserved from decay and the worm by the great bitterness of its sap, but also it cannot be kindled with fire nor ignite of itself, unless, like stones in a lime kiln, it is burned with other wood. And even then it does not take fire nor produce burning coals, but after a long time it slowly consumes away. This is because there is a very small proportion of the elements of fire and air in its composition, which is a dense and solid mass of moisture and the earthy, so that it has no open pores through which fire can find its way. But it repels the force of fire and does not let itself be harmed by it quickly. Further, its weight will not let it float in water, so that when transported it is loaded on shipboard or on rafts made of fir. 15. It is worthwhile to know how this wood was discovered. The divine Caesar, being with his army in the neighborhood of the Alps, and having ordered the towns to furnish supplies, the inhabitants of a fortified stronghold there, called Larignum, trusting in the natural strength of their defenses, refused to obey his command. So the general ordered his forces to the assault. In front of the gate of this stronghold there was a tower, made of beams of this wood laid in alternating directions at right angles to each other, like a funeral pyre, and built high so that they could drive off an attacking party by throwing stakes and stones from the top. When it was observed that they had no other missiles than stakes, and that these could not be hurled very far from the wall on account of the weight, orders were given to approach and throw bundles of brushwood and lighted torches at this outwork. These the soldiers soon got together. 16. The flames soon kindled the brushwood which lay about the wooden structure, and, rising towards heaven, made everybody think that the whole pile had fallen. But when the fire had burned itself out and subsided, and the tower appeared to view entirely uninjured, Caesar, in amazement, gave orders that they should be surrounded with a palisade, built beyond the range of missiles. So the townspeople were frightened into surrendering, and were then asked where that wood came from which was not harmed by fire. They pointed to trees of the kind under discussion, of which there were a very great number in that vicinity, And so, as that stronghold was called Larignum, the wood was called larch. It is transported by way of the Po to Ravenna, and is to be had in Fano, Pesaro, Ancona, and the other towns in that neighbourhood. If there were only a ready method of carrying this material to Rome, it would be of the greatest use in buildings. If not for general purposes, yet at least if the boards used in the eaves running round blocks of houses were made of it, the buildings would be free from the danger of fire spreading across to them, because such boards can neither take fire from flames or from burning coals, nor ignite spontaneously. 17. The leaves of these trees are like those of the pine. Timber from them comes in long lengths, is as easily wrought in joiner's work as is the clear wood of fir, and contains a liquid resin of the color of Attic honey, which is good for consumptives. With regard to the different kinds of timber, I have now explained of what natural properties they appear to be composed and how they were produced. It remains to consider the question why the highland fir, as it is called in Rome, is inferior, while the lowland fir is extremely useful in buildings so far as durability is concerned, and further to explain how it is that their bad or good qualities seem to be due to the peculiarities of their neighbourhood, so that this subject may be clearer to those who examine it. Chapter 10. Highland and Lowland Fir. 1. The first spurs of the Apennines arise from the Tuscan Sea between the Alps and the most distant borders of Tuscany. The mountain range itself bends round and, almost touching the shores of the Adriatic in the middle of the curve, completes its circuit by extending to the strait on the other shore. Hence, this side of the curve, sloping towards the districts of Tuscany and Campania, lies basking in the sun, being constantly exposed to the full force of its rays all day. But the further side, sloping towards the upper sea and having a northern exposure, is constantly shrouded in shadowy darkness. Hence the trees which grow on that side, being nourished by the moisture, not only themselves attain to a very large size, but their fibre too, filled full of moisture, is swollen and distended with abundance of liquid. When they lose their vitality after being felled and hewn, the fibre retains its stiffness, and the trees as they dry become hollow and frail on account of their porosity, and hence cannot last when used in buildings. 2. But trees which grow in places facing the courses of the sun are not of porous fibre, but are solid, being drained by the dryness. For the sun absorbs moisture and draws it out of trees as well as out of the earth. The trees in sunny neighbourhoods, therefore, being solidified by the compact texture of their fibre, and not being porous from moisture, are very useful, so far as durability goes, when they are hewn into timber. Hence the lowland firs, being conveyed from sunny places, are better than those of highland firs, which are brought here from shady places. 3. To the best of my mature consideration, I have now treated the materials which are necessary in the construction of buildings, the proportionate amount of the elements which are seen to be contained in the natural composition, and the points of excellence and defects of each kind, so that they may be not unknown to those who are engaged in building. Thus, those who can follow the directions contained in this treatise will be better informed in advance and able to select among the different kinds those which will be of use in their works. Therefore, since the preliminaries have been explained, the buildings themselves will be treated in the remaining books. And first, as due order requires, I shall in the next book write of the temples of the immortal gods and their symmetrical proportions. End of Book 2. Book 3, Introduction and Chapters 1 to 2 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Book 3, Introduction. 1. Apollo at Delphi, through the oracular utterance of his priestess, pronounced Socrates the wisest of men. Of him it is related that he said with sagacity and great learning that the human breast should have been furnished with open windows so that men might not keep their feelings concealed, but have them open to the view. O that nature, following his idea, had constructed them thus unfolded and obvious to the view. For if it had been so, not merely the virtues and vices of the mind would be easily visible, but also its knowledge of branches of study displayed to the contemplation of the eyes would not need testing by untrustworthy powers of judgment, but a singular and lasting influence would thus be lent to the learned and wise. However, since they are not so constructed, but are as nature willed them to be, it is impossible for men, while natural abilities are concealed in the breast, to form a judgment on the quality of the knowledge of the arts, which is thus deeply hidden. And if artists themselves testify to their own skill, they can never, unless they are wealthy or famous from the age of their studios, or unless they are also possessed of the public favor and of eloquence, have an influence commensurate with their devotion to their pursuits, so that people may believe them to have the knowledge which they profess to have. 2. In particular, we can learn this from the case of the sculptors and painters of antiquity. Those among them who were marked by high station or favorably recommended have come down to posterity with a name that will last forever. For instance, Myron, Polycletus, Phidias, Lysippus, and the others who have attained to fame by their art. For they acquired it by the execution of works for great states or for kings or for citizens of rank, by those who, being men of no less enthusiasm, natural ability and dexterity than those famous artists, and who executed no less perfectly finished works for citizens of low station, are unremembered, not because they lacked diligence or dexterity in their art, but because fortune failed them. For instance, Tellias of Athens, Chion of Corinth, Myager the Phocenian, Pharax of Ephesus, Boedas of Byzantium, and many others. Then there were painters like Aristomenes of Thasos, Polycles and Andron of Ephesus, Theo of Magnesia, and others who were not deficient in diligence or enthusiasm for their art or in dexterity, but whose narrow means or ill luck or the higher position of their rivals in the struggle for honor stood in the way of their attaining distinction. 3. Of course, we need not be surprised if artistic excellence goes unrecognized on account of being unknown, but there should be the greatest indignation when, as often, good judges are flattered by charm of social entertainments into an approbation which is a mere pretense. Now if, as Socrates wished, our feelings, opinions, and knowledge gained by study had been manifest and clear to see, popularity and adulation would have no influence, but men who had reached the height of knowledge by means of correct and definite courses of study would be given commissions without any effort on their part. However, since such things are not plain and apparent to the view as we think they should have been, and since I observe that the uneducated rather than the educated are in higher favor, thinking it beneath me to engage me with the uneducated in the struggle for honor, I prefer to show the excellence of our department of knowledge by the publication of this treatise. 4. In my first book, Emperor, I described to you the art with its points of excellence, the different kinds of training with which the architect ought to be equipped, adding the reasons why he ought to be skillful in them, and I divided up the subject of architecture as a whole among its departments, duly defining the limits of each. Next, as was preeminent and necessary, I explained on scientific principles the method of selecting healthy sites for fortified towns, pointed out by geometrical figures the different winds and the quarters from which they blow, and show the proper way to lay out the lines of streets and rows of houses within the walls. Here I fixed the end of my first book. In the second, on building materials, I treated their various advantages in structures and the natural properties of which they are composed. In this third book I shall speak of the temples of the immortal gods, describing and explaining them in the proper manner. Chapter 1. On Symmetry, in Temples and in the Human Body. 1. The design of a temple depends on symmetry, the principles of which must be most carefully observed by the architect. They are due to proportion, in Greek, analogia. Proportion is a correspondence among the measures of the members of an entire work, and of the whole to a certain part selected as standard. From this result the principles of symmetry. Without symmetry and proportion there can be no principles in the design of any temple, that is, if there is no precise relation between its members, as in the case of those of a well-shaped man. 2. For the human body is so designed by nature that the face, from the chin to the top of the forehead and the lowest roots of the hair, is a tenth part of the whole height. The open hand from the wrist to the tip of the middle finger is just the same. The head from the chin to the crown is an eighth. And with the neck and shoulder from the top of the breast to the lowest roots of the hair is a sixth. From the middle of the breast to the summit of the crown is a fourth. If we take the height of the face itself, the distance from the bottom of the chin to the underside of the nostrils is one-third of it, the nose from the underside of the nostrils to a line between the eyebrows is the same. From there the lowest roots of the hair is also a third, comprising the forehead. The length of the foot is one-sixth of the height of the body, of the forearm one-fourth, and the breadth of the breast is also one-fourth. The other members, too, have their own symmetrical proportion, and it was by employing them that the famous painters and sculptors of antiquity attained to great and endless renown. 3. Similarly, in the members of a temple there ought to be the greatest harmony in the symmetrical relations of the different parts of the general magnitude of the whole. Then again, in the human body the central point is naturally the navel. For if a man be placed flat on his back, with his hands and feet extended, and a pair of compasses centered at his navel, the fingers and toes of his two hands and feet will touch the circumference of a circle described therefrom. And just as the human body yields a circular outline, so too a square figure may be found from it. For if we measure the distance from the soles of the feet to the top of the head, and then apply that measure to the outstretched arms, the breadth will be found to be the same as the height, as in the case of plane surfaces which are perfectly square. 4. Therefore, since nature has designed the human body so that its members are duly proportioned to the frame as a whole, it appears that the ancients had good reasons for their rule, that in perfect buildings the different members must be in exact symmetrical relations to the whole general scheme. Hence, while transmitting to us the proper arrangements for buildings of all kinds, they were particularly careful to do so in the case of temples of the gods, buildings in which merits and faults usually last forever. 5. Further, it was from the members of the body that they derived the fundamental ideas of the measures which are obviously necessary in all works, as the finger, palm, foot, and cubit. These they apportioned so as to form the perfect number, called in Greek teleion, and as the perfect number the ancients fixed upon 10. For it is from the number of the fingers of the hand that the palm is found, and the foot from the palm. Again, while 10 is naturally perfect as being made up by the fingers of the two palms, Plato also held that this number was perfect because 10 is composed of the individual units called by the Greeks monades. But as soon as 11 or 12 is reached, the numbers being excessive cannot be perfect until they come to 10 for second time, for the component part of that number are the individual units. 6. The mathematicians, however, maintaining a different view, have said that the perfect number is 6, because this number is composed of integral parts which are suited numerically to their method of reckoning. Thus, 1 is 1/6. 2 is 1/3, 3 is 1/2, 4 is 2/3, or demoiros, as they call it, 5 is 5/6, called pentamoiros, and 6 is the perfect number. As the number goes on growing larger, the addition of a unit above 6 is the effectus, 8, formed by the addition of a third part of 6, is the integer, and the third, called epitritos. The addition of 1/2 makes 9, the integer and a half, termed hemiolios. The addition of 2/3, making the number 10, is the integer and 2/3, which they call epidemoiros. In the number 11, where 5 are added, we have the 5/6, called epipemptos. Finally, 12, being composed of the two simple integers, is called Diplasios. 7. And further, as the foot is 1/6 of a man's height, the height of the body as expressed in number of feet being limited to 6, they held that this was the perfect number, and observed that the cubit consisted of 6 palms or of 24 fingers. This principle seems to have been followed by the states of Greece. As the cubit consisted of 6 palms, they made the drachma, which they used as their unit, consist in the same way of 6 bronze coins, like our asses, which they call obols, and to correspond to the fingers, divided the drachma into 24 quarter obols, which some call dichalsa, others trichalsa. 8. But our countrymen at first fixed upon the ancient number and made 10 bronze pieces go to the denarius, and this is the origin of the name which is applied to the denarius to this day. And the fourth part of it, consisting of 2 asses and half of a third, they called sesterce. But later, observing the 6 and 10 were both of them perfect numbers, they combined the two, and thus made the most perfect number 16. They found their authority for this in the foot, for if we take 2 palms from the cubit, there remains the foot of 4 palms, but the palm contains 4 fingers. Hence the foot contains 16 fingers, and the denarius the same number of bronze asses. 9. Therefore, if it is agreed that number was found out from the human fingers, and that there is a symmetrical correspondence between the members separately and the entire form of the body, in accordance with a certain part selected at standard, we can have nothing but respect for those who, in constructing temples of the immortal gods, have so arranged the members of the works that both the separate parts and the whole design may harmonize in their proportions and symmetry. Chapter 2. Classification of Temples. 1. There are certain elementary forms on which the general aspect of a temple depends. First, there is the temple in Antis, or Naos and Parastasin, as it is called in Greek. Then the prostyle, amphiprostyle, peripteral, pseudodipteral, dipteral, and hypetral. These different forms may be described as follows. 2. It will be a temple in Antis when it has antae carried out in front of the walls which enclose the cella, and in the middle, between the antae, 2 columns, and over them the pediment constructed in the symmetrical proportions to be described later in this work. An example will be found at the 3 fortuned, in that one of the 3 which is nearest the Colline gate. 3. The prostyle is in all respects like the temple in Antis, except that at the corners opposite the antae it has 2 columns, and that it has architraves not only in front, as in the case of the temple in Antis, but also one to the right and one to the left in the wings. An example of this is the temple of Juve and Faunus in the island of the Tiber. 4. The amphiprostyle is in all other respects like the prostyle, but has besides in the rear the same arrangement of columns and pediment. 5. A temple will be peripteral, that has 6 columns in front and 6 in the rear, with 11 on each side, including the corner columns. Let the columns be so placed as to leave a space, the width of an intercolumniation, all round between the walls and the rows of columns on the outside, thus forming a walk round the cella of the temple, as in the cases of the temple of Jupiter Stator by Hermodorus in the portico of Metellus, and the Marian temple of honor and valor constructed by Musius, which has no portico in the rear. 6. The pseudodipteral is so constructed that in front and in the rear there are in each case 8 columns, with 15 on each side, including the corner columns. The walls of the cella in front and in the rear should be directly over against the 4 middle columns. Thus there will be a space, the width of 2 intercolumniations, plus the thickness of the lower diameter of a column, all round between the walls and the rows of columns on the outside. There is no example of this in Rome, but at Magnesia there is the temple of Diana by Hermogenes, and that of Apollo at Alabanda by Mnesthes. 7. The dipteral also is octastyle in both front and rear porticos, but it has two rows of columns all round the temple, like the temple of Quirinus, which is Doric, and the temple of Diana at Ephesus, planned by Chersiphron, which is Ionic. 8. The hypaethral is decastyle in both front and rear porticos. In everything else, it is the same as the dipteral, but inside it has two tiers of columns set out from the wall all around, like the colonnade of the peristyle. The central part is open to the sky without a roof, folding doors leading to it at each end, in the porticos in front and in the rear. There is no example of this sort in Rome, but in Athens there is the octastyle in the precinct of the Olympian. End of Book 3, Chapter 2. Book 3, Chapters 3 and 4 of 10 Books on Architecture. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Recording by Fredrik Karlsson. 10 Books on Architecture by Vitruvius. Translated by Morris Hickey Morgan. Chapter 3. The Proportions of Intercolumniations and of Columns. 1. There are five classes of temples, designated as follows. Pycnostyle, with the columns close together, systyle, with the intercolumniations a little wider, diastyle, more open still, areostyle, farther apart than they ought to be, evstyle, with the intervals apportioned just right. 2. The pycnostyle is a temple in an intercolumniation of which the thickness of a column and a half can be inserted. For example, the temple of the divine Caesar, that of Venus in Caesar's Forum, and others constructed like them. The systyle is a temple in which the thickness of the two columns can be placed in an intercolumniation, and in which the plinth of the bases are equivalent to the distance between the two plinths. For example, the temple of Equestrian Fortune near the Stone Theatre, and the others which are constructed on the same principles. 3. These two kinds have practical disadvantages. When the matrons mount the steps for public prayer or thanksgiving, they cannot pass through the intercolumniations with their arms about one another, but must form single file. Then again, the effect of the folding doors is thrust out of sight by the crowding of the columns, and likewise the statues are thrown into shadow. The narrow space interferes also with walks round the temple. 4. The construction will be diastyle when we can insert the thickness of the three columns into an intercolumniation, as in the case of the temple of Apollo and Diana. This arrangement involves the danger that the architraves may break on account of the great width of the intervals. In areostyles, we cannot employ stone or marble for the architraves, but must have a series of wooden beams laid upon the columns, and moreover, in appearance these temples are clumsy roofed, low, broad, and their pediments are adorned in the Tuscan fashion with statues of terracotta or gilt bronze. For example, near the Circus Maximus, the Temple of Ceres and Pompey's Temple of Hercules, also the Temple on the Capitol. 6. An account must now be given of the evstyle, which is the most approved class, and is arranged on principles developed with a view to convenience, beauty, and strength. The intervals should be made as wide as the thickness of the two columns and a quarter, but the middle intercolumniations, one in front and the other in the rear, should be of the thickness of three columns. Thus built, the effect of the design will be beautiful, there will be no obstructions at the entrance, and the walk round the cella will be dignified. 7. The rule of this arrangement may be set forth as follows. If a tetrastyle is to be built, let the width of the front, which shall have already been determined for the temple, be divided into 11 parts and a half, not including the substructures and the projections of the bases. If it is to be of 6 columns, into 18 parts. If an octastyle is to be constructed, let the front be divided in 24 parts and a half. Then, whether the temple is to be tetrastyle, hexastyle, or octastyle, let one of these parts be taken, and it will be the module. The thickness of the columns will be equal to one module. Each of the intercolumniations, except those in the middle, will measure 2 modules and a quarter. The middle intercolumniation in front and in rear will each measure 3 modules. The columns themselves will be 9 modules and a half in height. As a result of this division, the intercolumniations and the heights of the columns will be in due proportion. 8. We have no example of this in Rome, but at Teos in Asia Minor there is one which is hexastyle, dedicated to Father Bacchus. These rules for symmetry were established by Hermogenes, who was also the first to devise the principle of the pseudodipteral octastyle. He did so by dispensing with the inner rows of the 38 columns which belonged to the symmetry of the dipteral temple, and in this he made a saving in expense and labor. He thus provided a much wider space for the walk round the cella between it and the columns, and without detracting at all from the general effect or making one feel the loss of what had been really superfluous, he preserved the dignity of the whole work by his new treatment of it. 9. For the idea of the pteroma and the arrangement of the columns round the temple were devised in order that the intercolumniation might give the imposing effect of high relief, and also, in case a multitude of people should be caught in a heavy shower and detained, that they might have in the temple and round the cella a wide free space in which to wait. These ideas are developed, as I have described, in the pseudodipteral arrangement of a temple. It appears, therefore, that Hermogenes produced results which exhibit much acute ingenuity, and that he left sources from which those who came after him could derive instructive principles. 10. In Areo-style temples, the columns should be constructed so that their thickness is 1/8 part of their height. In the diastyle, the height of a column should be measured off into 8.5 parts, and the thickness of the column fixed at one of these parts. In the systyle, let the height be divided into 9.5 parts, and one of these given to the thickness of the column. In the pycnostyle, the height should be divided into 10 parts, and one of these used for the thickness of the column. In the evstyle temple, let the height of the column be divided, as in the systyle, into 9.5 parts, and let one part be taken for the thickness at the bottom of the shaft. With these dimensions we shall be taking into account the proportions of the intercolumniations. 11. For the thickness of the shafts must be enlarged in proportion to the increase of the distance between the columns. In the area style, for instance, if only 1/9 or 1/10 part is given to the thickness, the column will look thin and mean, because the width of the intercolumniations is such that the air seems to eat away and diminish the thickness of such shafts. On the other hand, in pycnostyles, if 1/8 part is given to the thickness, it will make the shaft look swollen and ungraceful, because the intercolumniations are so close to each other and so narrow. We must therefore follow the rules of symmetry required by each kind of building. Then, too, the columns at the corners should be made thicker than the others by 1/50 of their own diameter, because they are sharply outlined by the unobstructed air round them, and seem to the beholder more slender than they are. Hence, we must counteract the ocular deception by an adjustment of proportions. 12. Moreover, the diminution in the top of a column at the necking seems to be regulated on the following principles. If a column is 15 feet or under, let the thickness at the bottom be divided into 6 parts, and let 5 of those parts form the thickness at the top. If it is from 15 feet to 20 feet, let the bottom of the shaft be divided into 6.5 parts, and let 5.5 of those parts be the upper thickness of the column. In a column of from 20 feet to 30 feet, let the bottom of the shaft be divided into 7 parts, and let the diminished top measure 6 of these. A column of from 30 to 40 feet should be divided at the bottom into 7.5 parts, and on the principle of diminution have 6.5 of these at the top. Columns of from 40 to 50 should be divided into 8 parts, and diminished to 7 of these at the top of the shaft under the capital. In the case of higher columns, let the diminution be determined proportionally on the same principles. 13. These proportionate enlargements are made in the thickness of columns on account of the different heights to which the eye has to climb. For the eye is always in search of beauty, and if we do not gratify its desire for pleasure by a proportionate enlargement in these measures, and thus make compensation for ocular deception, a clumsy and awkward appearance will be presented to the beholder. With regard to the enlargement made at the middle of columns, which among the Greeks is called entasis, at the end of the book a figure and calculations will be subjoined, showing how an agreeable and appropriate effect may be produced by it. Chapter 4. The Foundations and Substructures of Temples. 1. The foundations of these works should be dug out of the solid ground, if it can be found, and carried down into solid ground as far as the magnitude of the work shall seem to require, and the whole substructure should be as solid as it can possibly be laid. Above ground, let walls be laid under the columns, thicker by one half than the columns are to be, so that the lower may be stronger than the higher. Hence they are called stereobates, for they take the load. And the projections of the bases should not extend beyond this solid foundation. The wall thickness is similarly to be preserved above ground likewise, and the intervals between these walls should be vaulted over or filled with earth, rammed down hard, to keep the walls well apart. 2. If, however, solid ground cannot be found, but the place proves to be nothing but a heap of loose earth to the very bottom, or a marsh, then it must be dug up and cleared out and set with piles made of charred alder or olive wood or oak, and these must be driven down by machinery very closely together like bridge piles, and the intervals between them filled in with charcoal, and finally the foundations are to be laid on them in the most solid form of construction. The foundations having been brought up to the level, the stylobates are next to be put in place. 3. The columns are then to be distributed over the stylobates in the manner above described, close together in the pycnostyle, in the systyle, diastyle, or evstyle as they are described and arranged above. In areostyle temples one is free to arrange them as far apart as one likes. Still, in peripterals the columns should be so placed that there are twice as many intercolumniations on the sides as there are in front, for thus the length of the work will be twice its breadth. Those who make the number of columns double seem to be in error, because then the length seems to be one intercolumniation longer than it ought to be. 4. The steps in front must be arranged so that there always be an odd number of them, for thus the right foot with which one mounts the first step will also be the first to reach the level of the temple itself. The rise of such steps should, I think, be limited to not more than 10 nor less than 9 inches, for then the ascent will not be difficult. The treads of the steps ought to be made not less than a foot and a half and not more than 2 feet deep. If there are to be steps running all round the temple, they should be built of the same size. 5. But if a podium is to be built on 3 sides round the temple, it should be so constructed that it plinths, bases, dies, coronae, and cymatiomare appropriate to the actual stylobate, which is to be under the bases of the columns. The level of the stylobate must be increased along the middle by the scamile impares, for if it is laid perfectly level, it will look to the eye as though it were hollowed a little. At the end of the book a figure will be found, with a description showing how the scamile may be made to suit this purpose. End of Book 3, Chapter 4.
Yeah, sure thing.
Hey, you sold that car yet?
Yeah, sold it to Carvana.
Oh, I thought you were selling to that guy.
The guy who wanted to pay me in foreign currency, no interest, over 36 months? Yeah, no. Carvana gave me an offer in minutes, picked it up, and paid me on the spot. It was so convenient.
Just like that?
Yeah.
No hassle?
None.
That is super convenient.
Sell your car to Carvana and swap hassle for convenience. Pickup fees may apply.
New year, same great savings. All in the Kroger app. Get Kroger Spiral Sliced Ham for 89 cents a pound with your card and an additional $25 purchase limit too. Then get large avocados or mangoes for 99 cents each with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.